Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys, Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges, working to encourage lawmakers to fund Florida's future through support of public education, online at myuff.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida House moves to dump the rules on where hospitals and nursing homes can be built.
Competition in most areas is good as long as we can make sure that the public is safe. The CON should go the way of the dinosaur.
Also tonight, a plan to add Bible study to Florida's public school curricula has some lawmakers asking, why not also study the Quran or the Tibetan Book of the Dead?
I don't know how you can have religious neutrality if your curriculum is just focused on one holy book.
We'll also fire up the latest on the smokable medical marijuana debate and delve into the question of how to go about placing a dollar value on human life. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day three of Florida's 2019 lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. The Florida House is moving forward with a big health care agenda at the direction of Speaker Jose Oliva, but as Lynn Hatter reports, that agenda is setting up clashes with some health care providers who say it could lead to worse, not better care.
House Speaker Jose Oliva likens health care in Florida to a five-alarm fire, and he's pinned his sights on eliminating state rules regarding where and when facilities like hospitals and nursing homes can be built.
We must look at the areas where government has gotten in the way. We must engage the consumer so that market forces can apply. And we must embrace new technologies. That is why we must get rid of policies like the Certificate of Need, which have only served to create local and regional monopolies.
The legislature has whittled away at the process known as Certificate of Need for years now, and it's poised to do away with it altogether. Republican Representative Heather Fitzenhagen says it's time for the system to go.
Competition in most areas is good as long as we can make sure that the public is safe. The CON should go the way of the dinosaur.
Fitzenhagen argues repeal would pave the way for the market to determine need and would allow for more transparency when it comes to pricing and better patient care.
Without a CON, there will be more beds available, more care in communities, and market forces will determine whether or not a hospital can exist or thrive.
The research on that goes both ways. The Mercatus Center at George Mason University found Certificate of Need laws don't increase access to health care for the poor, but they can limit the supply of such services. But research from the Florida State University College of Medicine found eliminating the rules could worsen the state's shortage of doctors and nurses. There could be more beds, but not enough people to work them. Florida Hospital Association lobbyist David Ashburn with Greenberg Traweg adds, removing those rules won't address litigation costs, which critics have said is a problem that arises when hospitals sue each other for the right to open facilities in certain areas.
There are things that can be done to the litigation process, because it is an administrative process, to pare that down further and reduce costs there. But elimination of the program in its entirety is not necessary to address that.
The Florida Healthcare Association represents nursing homes, and its lobbyist Bob Estellos says creating nursing homes and hospice centers in places they aren't needed results in an overall drop in occupancy. He says that can end up costing the state more money than it would save.
We're afraid that if you eliminate the CON process, and our occupancy falls, you may see unintended consequences of these market forces, where nursing homes will work to keep their beds full. And so this, again, the keeping nursing homes full benefits the state. So with that, we would ask that you remove nursing homes from the bill.
Well, I think almost everyone said they'd like to be exempted from that bill.
That's House Speaker Jose Oliva again.
I think we are starting with the premise that certificates of need have not been helpful. This bill has to go through the process, and it has to go through the Senate, and we have to have a conversation about it. I don't know where the bill will end up, but I know that it must end up in a place that is meaningful and prevents the monopolies that we created through those policies.
Previous attempts to eliminate certificate of need have given nursing homes a carve-out, but a complete repeal of certificate of need has historically failed to gain traction in the state Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A bill that would create an elective Bible study course in public high schools has cleared the House Pre-K through 12 Quality Subcommittee. Ryan Daly reports its sponsor is adamant her measure is constitutional.
Representative Kimberly Daniels says her bill's constitutionality is based on a 1963 U.S. Supreme Court opinion, as long as the courses are taught objectively.
House Bill 195 protects constitutional rights of students to be free from impermissible religious instruction by requiring an objective study of the Bible that does not convert or evangelize students.
Daniels says that means curriculum created by her bill would have to follow state and federal guidelines regarding religious neutrality. Some committee members pointed out different versions of the Bible are used in various religions. Daniels says students can choose between translations.
School districts would offer elective courses on Hebrew scripture and the Old Testament. A student can choose whichever Bible translation, Hebrew or the New Testament, that they would like to study.
But Representative Anna Eskamani challenges the idea of having religious objectivity and neutrality with courses that are based on one religious text.
I just struggle on the point that Rep. Hogan Johnson made earlier about religious neutrality with one book. It just doesn't seem like that connects to me.
Eskamani also asked Daniels about texts from other religions being offered under the measure.
My family's Iranian American. Majority of my family identifies with Islam. Would you consider adding the Quran to your bill to be a friendly amendment as another holy book that can be taught objectively to your language?
You're recognized.
No.
Meanwhile, Representative Chris Latvala says students can benefit from the Bible's historical offerings.
There are students that want to take this and they want to learn the Bible from a historical perspective. You can learn a lot of history in the Bible, secular history as well as religious history.
Representative David Santiago, who ultimately voted yes, was among those concerned about a funding source. He asked Daniels about it during the meeting.
Is there a funding mechanism that's going to follow this either in a separate bill or later on with this bill to help the schools pay for the curriculum?
No, not at this time.
Despite Daniels' insistence that the measure can stand the constitutionality test on the strength of an opinion from the nation's highest court, one of her colleagues disagrees. Representative Jennifer Webb was one of the three Democrats who cast a no vote.
I did find 9 federal court decisions, including one from Florida, ruling that public school Bible courses were unconstitutional in whole or in part. In Gibson versus Lee County, which is a decision from the Middle District of Florida, my district, the court invalidated the Bible history course of the New Testament because it could not conceive how the resurrection of miracles could be taught as secular history.
Several representatives are asking Daniels to modify the bill because the statute it looks to change does not apply to charter schools. The measure will next head to the Pre-K-12 Appropriations Subcommittee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Governor DeSantis and many lawmakers are eager to banish red tide and blue-green algae from state waters, but that may be easier said than done.
When you're trying to get money on a year-to-year basis for something that that you need to be more aggressive about, you're always going to be behind.
One Florida lawmaker wants to cap pain and suffering payments at $1 million, but others ask, how can you put a dollar value on a human life?
The idea that money can compensate someone for the loss of a human life is almost offensive, okay? But that is the system that we have.
And where should Florida beer fans flock to enjoy the best brew in the state? We'll let you in on the secret.
Sometimes people will be like, oh, I wanted to come in, but it was just so busy. So I hate when I hear that.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
On the very first day of this legislative session, Governor Ron DeSantis talked about improving Florida's water quality. Toxic algae once again fouled Central and South Florida waterways, resulting in one of the longest outbreaks in years. In addition, the governor has promised additional funding to continue Everglades restoration efforts. But as WMFE's Amy Green reports, some are wondering about other troubled waterways.
Along the Indian River Lagoon, the local newspaper hit driveways when January morning with a plea on the front page.
Please don't forget us here in Brevard.
Isadora Rangel is a Florida Today editor.
Maybe a month after Ron DeSantis' election, we sat down as an editorial board, and I'm the leader, and I proposed that we do a series of editorials with priorities for the new governor. And the first one was a no-brainer for us.
The rare front page editorial pointed out that while 3 years have passed since a stunning fish kill here filled the lagoon with floating carcasses, problems remain as urgent as ever.
It is an issue that's unique to Brevard, but it is an issue that affects everyone. It's a bipartisan issue, and it's an issue not only that we love the environment, but that we rely on that environment.
Among other things, the editorial touted a measure filed by Representative Randy Fine, a Republican, that would put $50 million towards septic upgrades along the lagoon.
People won't fish in it. People won't boat in it. People won't swim in it. People look at it as a cesspool, and we have to do something about it.
Governor Ron DeSantis has presented a bold plan for rescuing Florida from the toxic algae that gripped the state last year, with millions of dollars for Everglades restoration and water quality. Legislatures will take up the newly elected governor's budget proposal during the session. But toxic algae is part of a bigger problem.
South Florida doesn't have a monopoly on harmful algal blooms.
Julie Raithmale of Audubon, Florida says across the state, harmful algae blooms are stressing waterways. That's what in 2016 caused the worst fish kill in the Indian River Lagoon in anyone's memory, when a bloom took hold, then died, stripping the water of oxygen.
Seen them in the St. John's River. There was also red tide in the Panhandle this summer. North Florida's freshwater springs have notoriously dealt with nutrient issues driving algal blooms in past decades.
DeSantis's plan puts money towards septic upgrades and water quality monitoring and research. Raithmale says that's a good start, but septic tanks are not the only thing causing the problems. Clay Henderson of Stetson University's Water Institute says there is an annual allocation for springs, but that last year's money remains unspent. He estimates restoring the Indian River Lagoon would cost about $1 billion, but says there's no dedicated funding for that.
We could plan to implement these restoration projects on a priority basis. But when you're trying to get money on a year-to-year basis for something that that you need to be more aggressive about, you're always going to be behind.
Most of the 156-mile Indian River Lagoon lies within Brevard County, and residents in 2016 approved a half-cent sales tax to raise money for restoration. But Florida Today editor Isadora Rangel says the state has contributed little. The newspaper's editorial called for more state funding and also better growth management to rein in the breakneck development adding to Florida's water woes. Rangel says the editorial has received a strong response.
We asked people to add their names to it, and they did it online as well, and then we also asked them to send us letters if they don't have access to a computer. And we've gotten over close to 1,300 signatures online, and we got a bunch of letters in the mail.
For the Indian River Lagoon and Florida's other troubled waterways, help can't come soon enough. Amy Green in Orlando.
In hopes of meeting Governor Ron DeSantis's March 15th deadline to repeal a ban on smoking medical marijuana, lawmakers in the Senate have sent their bill to the Florida House, but not without making a few changes first. Blaze Ganey has more.
Broward County Democratic Senator Gary Farmer says when 72% of voters passed the 2016 amendment legalizing medical marijuana, they wanted smoking to be allowed. To make sure there were no doubters on the Senate floor Thursday, he read an excerpt from the 2016 ballot proposal.
Nothing in this section shall require any accommodation of any on-site medical use or marijuana in correctional institution or detention facility or place of education or employment, comma, or of smoking medical marijuana in any public place. Clearly, that language implies that smoking of marijuana in a private place shall be allowed.
While the House bill requires patients to buy pre-rolled marijuana cigarettes, the Senate allows patients to have the full flower. But the bill has limits to how much can be prescribed. On the floor, senators approved an amendment for patients suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease, also known as ALS. Brandis explains.
It allows a physician to apply to the DOH for an exception to the 2.5 ounce purchase limit and the 4 ounce possession limit for qualifying patients. Some patients with Lou Gehrig's disease and other diseases may need more, and we need to create a pathway for them outside this current pathway, and so that's what this provision allows.
Senators tried to make a few other changes Thursday. Farmer attempted to add on 3 late-filed amendments.
Anything we can do to alleviate the reliance on opioid medication, I think we all would agree is good policy. And so what this amendment would do would be provide free medical marijuana access cards to our veterans.
Another Farmer amendment addresses the workplace.
And so what this amendment would do would limit an employer's ability to terminate an employee who tests positive for marijuana in a drug test who is a licensed cardholder.
But the amendment would allow employers to fire an employee who used the drug on the job. Farmer's third proposed amendment would fix a problem he says he found through research.
I was shocked to learn that some patients who are on transplant lists for kidney or other organs are being dropped from the list simply because they are shown as a licensed cardholder under the database.
The amendment would provide discrimination protections against medical marijuana license cardholders on a transplant list. Citing the looming deadline, Farmer agreed to withdraw his amendments, but he said he expects to file a bill addressing all the licensure issues in the future. Meanwhile, another senator had a change he'd like to see as well, but for a different part of the medical marijuana system.
There's a need for serious discussion, not only on the compliance, but there's a need for a discussion of the MMT licensing procedure as a whole. Vertical integration is simply not working for Floridian, and it's certainly not working for my community.
That's Fort Lauderdale Democratic Senator Perry Thurston. He says blacks are the most discriminated against when applying for licenses and says that's a reflection of how they are treated when it comes to possession of marijuana. In Florida, blacks are 4 times more likely to be charged for cannabis possession. He says those numbers, county by county, are even worse.
According to the Tampa Bay Times and Pinellas, Hillsboro, African Americans are 6 times more likely to be arrested. Gainesville Sun, cited by the ACLU, found that 6.6 times more likely. Additionally, Sarasota County has the largest disparity in the state, where African Americans are 10 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession.
Governor Ron DeSantis is also pushing for the vertical integration system to be broken up before the end of session. He calls it a cartel. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaze Ganey.
Lawmakers are working to tamp down on the state's reputation as one of the worst places for litigation in the country. Regan McCarthy reports a tort reform measure is now moving forward in the House.
One of the better-known tort cases centers on Stella Liebeck, the woman who sued McDonald's after a spilled cup of coffee left her with serious injuries.
The New York Times recently produced a mini-documentary on it.
An elderly woman was severely burned when she spilled a cup of McDonald's coffee in her lap.
An 81-year-old woman has been awarded $2.9 million.
Liebeck was in the passenger seat of a parked car with her grandson. She had ordered a cup of coffee from the McDonald's drive-thru, and they pulled over. She put her cup of coffee in her lap to add cream and spilled the scalding liquid, sustaining serious burns. Liebeck sued McDonald's to get the company to reduce the temperature of its coffee, but many point to her tort case as an example of just how frivolous some say lawsuits have become. Daytona Beach Republican Representative Tom Leak says too often, tort cases are no longer about righting a wrong.
If you have any question about that, just drive down the highway where you can see billboards that don't talk about right and wrong. They talk about how much money somebody got them.
Leak says the issue is especially concerning in Florida.
Whether you accept the American Tort Reform Foundation declaring, you know, the state of Florida as the second worst judicial hellhole in the country, or you want to use the United States Chamber's survey finding it the fifth worst litigation environment in the country, it's up to you.
Leak is sponsoring a tort reform bill that would, among other things, cap the amount of money a person can be awarded for non-economic losses like pain and suffering at $1 million. Leslie Kroger works with the Florida Justice Association. She told a panel of lawmakers that in some cases the proposed cap wouldn't make sense.
I have a client who was 18 years old. He was catastrophically injured in a case. He can't move. He is in a wheelchair. He will be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And what you would be saying as a body, if you vote on this bill, that what he lives through every day is only worth $1 million for the rest of this young man's life.
And Lauderdale Lakes Democratic Representative Anika Umfroy questions how Leak decided $1 million is the right number.
I see that you went and you looked at other states and their $1 million cap sounded good to you, but how do you put a value on a life? And that is my concern. We have lots of discussions here. I'm a newbie. So we have lots of discussions about how life is priceless, and yet and still we're putting a price on life.
Leak agrees it's not possible to put a value on human life, but he says something needs to be done to change the current system.
I mean, there's no way to do that. And the idea that money can compensate someone for the loss of a human life is almost offensive. Okay? But that is the system that we have. And so what we've got to do is we've got to balance. You know, we've got to balance the rights of the injured with the rights of every other resident in the state of Florida who's bearing the cost of a broken system. So whether it's $1 million or some other number, I don't know. But understand that what happens when you put a cap on it is you provide predictability.
Leak says that's important because it helps insurance carriers understand their risk and set informed premiums, and gives residents and business owners confidence the cost of coverage won't keep going up. A similar measure has been filed in the Senate, but has not yet been scheduled for a first committee hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
There are lots of time-honored traditions surrounding the Florida legislature, things like the presence of gardens worth of flowers on the desks of members during the session's opening day, and the use of a dropped handkerchief in between the House and Senate chambers to signal the end of session. And there's also the treasured tradition of escaping Tallahassee by midday each Friday, at least during the first part of the 60-day session, before any sense of real urgency kicks in. That said, here's Gina Jordan with a preview of tomorrow's somewhat minimalist action at the Florida Capitol.
Here's a look at what's happening tomorrow at the Capitol. The House has no committee meetings. The full Senate has scheduled a two-hour meeting, then lawmakers can head home by lunchtime. A host of other panels will gather to discuss state business. They include Florida's Commission on Ethics, the Revenue Estimating Impact Conference, and the State Board of Medicine. Looking ahead to next week, legislative committees will have a four-day schedule, with neither chamber planning any meetings on Friday. Lawmakers will consider bills about emotional support animals, cyber harassment, and substance abuse services. That's some of what's happening in the Florida legislature. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, after hours of listening to public policy debates and political posturing, as well as racing all over the Capitol, one might be tempted to slip away to a friendly tap room and hoist a cold one. But the best place to do that hoisting may be hundreds of miles from Tallahassee. A Southwest Florida tap room was just named the best beer bar in the state. WGCU's Rachel Iacovone takes us inside.
Ave Maria is known for its towering cathedral-like oratory in the town center, for its manicured lawns, for its law school, for being owned by the creator of Domino's Pizza. What it can now be known for, though, is its craft beer selection.
I'm really into a lot of our local breweries here are awesome. We frequent them a lot on our tap list. We'll have Pointe Bell, Palm City, Bonehook, Momentum.
Oil Well Craft Beer was recently named the best beer bar in Florida by craftbeer.com. From the outside, the bar is as unassuming as any other shop in town. But upon entering, you'll often be greeted by a packed house of laughing locals and visitors from nearby Naples and Immokalee. The menu board is filled with eclectic offerings, and whatever food truck is out front during your visit offers just as unique a fare. The place is everything its owners, Matthew and Danae Williams, dreamed of, and more. Though their success means they're running out of room.
Sometimes people will be like, oh, I wanted to come in, but it was just so busy, so I hate when I hear that, because I want everyone to be able to come in and have a great time if we have something, you know, fun going on. And so it'll be great when we can have the extra space that we need.
Craftbeer.com's annual survey, voted on by its several thousand readers, named Oil Well Craft Beer the best beer bar. But the taproom plans to become a brewery in the near future. The Williams have purchased the cigar and vape shop next door and are in the process of knocking out the wall between the spaces to make room for their own brewing equipment.
We're doing a smaller brewing system. I mean, it's big enough to really crank out some beer, but you won't come in here and see all 20 of our taps with Oil Well, this or that. You know, at least half, at least 10 taps, if not 12 or so, will be guest taps. So you'll still see a wide selection of crazy beers.
It's decisions like this that have made Oil Well a standout among some pretty stiff competition. Right now, they have a crowler machine, not a growler, those big glass jugs, a crowler, as in those large cans of beer, typically only found at places that brew themselves. You can get a crowler of anything on the menu, like the Coconut Loconut Cider from Pierced Cider Work in Fort Pierce, or Red Cypress Brewery's Death Roll Stout on Nitro out of Winter Springs. The menu changes by day, though, so one visit may not be enough. I'm Rachel Iacovone in Ave Maria.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaze Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. You can hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys, Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty, staff professionals, and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges. Advocates for quality higher education for all Floridians. Online at myuff.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.